The 2020-2021 season did not begin with intrepid fans chuntering up the hill to the Medeski Stadium filled with the boisterous optimism of a new football season. Instead, we sat huddled around our laptops and televisions, desperate for an escape from the outside world. Cause for optimism is in short supply, but Veljko Paunović's Reading FC delivered from the off, a ray of glorious sunshine from the dark clouds that hung over us all. Suddenly, the fans had a team to adore, to enjoy and to be proud of once again. All season long, we tuned in, eager for another glimpse into our footballing dreamland. Alas, just as spring had sprung, Reading's season died down into a familiar, sullen reality. What we were left with is not an exhilarating playoff period or the ecstasy of a promotion parade, but instead the elegant calm of reflection on a season that charmed, churned and captivated us when we needed football the most. Welcome to the Tireless Den Podcast season review. Yes, we're here probably about a fortnight earlier than we wanted to be to review the season and see what exactly led Reading to seventh place in the championship season. I'm your host, Mark Mayo, and to see out the season with me is the Tireless Den assistant editor, Ollie Allen. The season in a sentence, Ollie.
I was about to say that was a very poetic introduction. The season in a sentence, expectations massively raised and then massively disappointing.
And also joining us this week is the view from the Dolan, or well, the view from the Dolan sofa, as it's been this season, hopefully a proper rebranding into being that the view from the Dolan next season is Ben Thomas. The season in a sentence for you.
How you doing, guys? Sparkling opening, even better middle, horrific ending.
Is that my intro summed up, or?
Well, do you know what? Like Ollie, I was genuinely spellbound for not the first time, Mark, I have to say, by what you were saying, but it was like a piece of Shakespeare. So there's no way I could have done that justice. But yeah, that would be my review of the season probably as well, actually. So yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you. Well, as if you enjoyed that intro and if you enjoy this podcast, then the virtual tip jar is always open with the Patreon subscribers for the Tireless Den podcast. And obviously the website keeps us ticking over. And also a big thank you to ZCZ Films, our sponsor, for the end of their second season with us. And we might have to get around the contract negotiation table and thrash out a deal, just as Reading will be doing with the pennies that are left over at the club at the end of this season then. So let's get into it. Let's recap the season.
Come rain or shine, it's time to relive the latest match action with the recap.
This podcast is sponsored by ZCZ Films, Reading's oldest ultras.
So I'm going to start us off by going through the story of the season by podcast episode titles, which I had a little look through in the week when I was doing the plan for this. And I think it gives us a good sense as to how the season has unfolded. So we started off with titles such as Kapow, Better and Better and Better, What on Earth is Going On, and Don't Stop Me Now. We then had It Had to End Somewhere, Playoffs or Bust? ? Christmas Cheer, Friday Night Fun. And then we go into Double Defeat, Just a Bad Night, Mission Impossible, Dashed and Deflated. Let's bring ourselves all the way back to the start of the season to begin this recap then, Ollie. And we spoke at the start of the season about potential 3-6-1 formations under Mark Bowen. We hadn't had a huge amount of transfer activity, just Josh Laurent, this central midfielder. Not many of us had really heard of from Shrewsbury coming in on a free transfer. It all seems like we were set for a pretty standard mid-table, lower mid-table season with, you know, maybe the good chance of a good end with a good young squad. That got completely shaken up by the news that Mark Bowen was being replaced by Veljko Paunović, a manager who was kind of unknown to pretty much everyone in Berkshire. And that pessimism that we had, perhaps, or, you know, some people had a bit of optimism, was it perhaps right or wrong for those of us who are a bit pessimistic going into the season?
I think it was more of a sense of just the complete unknown. I mean, as you say, you know, Paunović, no one had heard of him unless you were an MLS fan or a fan of the Serbia under-20s. And I think it was just that. And I think it was almost a sense that things, yes, they were slightly unstable, but with Mark Bowen in charge, the fact that we'd gone through the whole summer having not made that change. And, you know, let's not forget that last season did end quite poorly under Mark Bowen. It certainly petered out, you know, certainly sort of post-lockdown. Reading were pretty poor. I think they won 2 out of 9 or 2 out of 8 post-lockdown. The home form wasn't great. The style of play, you know, wasn't that great to watch. But, you know, obviously we went through the summer without a change having been made. Mark Bowen looked as if he was going to be the man going into the new season. And then they made that change, you know, 2 weeks before the start of the season, 1 week before the first round of the Carabao Cup. And I think that's probably where the pessimism, if you want to call it, came from, is the fact that it almost seemed as if the whole plan for the season had been thrown into complete disarray just 1 week before the start of the season. And whether it was anything against Paunovic in particular, I don't think so. Obviously, it was unknown, but I think it was more, I think certainly from my point of view, it was almost anger and just sort of confusion at quite what was going on. You know, I have to say, you know, I hadn't heard of Veljko Paunovic, and I must admit now that he's done a fantastic job, you know, despite sort of the way the season has finished. But, you know, I suppose a public apology for Veljko is fitting because of what he's gone on to do this season. I think you look at sort of the way our squad looked at the start of the season, it was very light. Obviously, we got rid of a lot of players last summer, didn't really bring anybody. Obviously, Josh Laurent came in on a free, Ajari signed permanently, but it was a very small squad, and sort of compared to previous summers, the recruitment, you know, was minimal. So I think the expectations were fair. I think, you know, anyone outside of Reading, sort of anyone around the championship or pundits were well in their right, really, to sort of say that Reading would be, you know, mid-table, lower mid-table based off the squad. And I think that start to the season just sort of, you know, stunned everybody.
Yeah, well, I remember one of the few games I got to this year was as the media for the Tottenham pre-season friendly, which was Mark Bowen's last game. And we had a little off-the-record chat, me and a few of the other reporters from that game. And we basically spoke to him, and he said he had no idea really what was going on. They'd offered him the chance to go and be director of football, and that there was this new guy coming in. The squad was going to Portugal to train with him because of obviously the restrictions in terms of travel. And it left me with a sense of real disappointment in the club, because it was the manner of the change that upset me. You know, whether if we, after the first or after the last game of last season, sorry, we'd have said, you know, okay, Mark Bowen, you're going to be removed, and we're going to put this new manager in who we've put in our faith in. I don't think many fans would have really been upset about that. We'd have said, okay, this is the direction the club wants to go in. But because it took so long to get to that point, and there was all the speculation, you know, you've got a manager taking charge of a team that he knows he's not going to be in charge of for much longer, just on the eve of the new season, I felt like that wasn't the right thing to do. And I still believe that it wasn't the right way to do it. We should have got Paunovic in earlier, and we might have actually, you know, had a more successful season if that had happened. But to flip that over, Ben, let's talk about what this team actually did have going for it going into the new season, in that, you know, that it is a decent squad, young players that we all knew at the start of the season, players like Michael Olise, Andy Winamota, John Swift, Jaku Mate. We knew there was quality in there. Paunovic wasn't a total rookie. He, you know, managed in these other places and done not too bad doing it. As Ollie says, Bowen had a poor end to last season. And actually, kind of the managerial changes that the Dai Young era has made under Reading, they've all improved the team, haven't they? Paul Clement to Gomez was an improvement, Gomez to Bowen was an improvement, and now we've seen Bowen to Paunovic as an improvement, and the club does deserve some sort of credit for that.
I think in the end they deserve credit for it. You know, it's always that kind of question that's been sort of bandied around the fan base recently. Would Bowen have done better, or is it Paunovic that's kind of trumped him on that? And I don't want to go down that road, because I think it's quite a crass question, and, you know, all this, if you take out the first 7 games or 8 games, we'd be relegating, all this sort of nonsense. It's ridiculous. I think the start surprised everyone. And I think it surprised everyone that wasn't inside the club at that point, because what had happened over the summer was that those younger players had been brought through and drilled by Bowen and his then team to kind of form what we had at Pride Park at the start of the season in September, in that first game where we just completely took them apart. Now, obviously, what we know now, you know, we're talking off there about Derby just about staying up. It probably was a fair result. But at the time, we'd not seen a Reading team go for it in that attacking sense for a long time. So that kind of sowed the seed for just an outstanding start that that no one in the fan base saw coming at all. And that kind of set up the expectations. I think what Pavlovic had was, as I said, a lean squad, but a squad that was capable of, on its day, competing with anyone in the division and potentially beating them. And that's what they showed in those first sort of seven, eight games or whatever. But the problem has been all the way through the season is that lean squad has then turned into almost a threadbare squad at times. You know, we had a bizarre situation where we had Arena before he got injured playing in lots of different positions, finally setting on right back, and then he was injured and that was it for the season. So there's been a reasonable amount of chopping and changing, but not to the level that you would expect other clubs, maybe the resources that they've got to kind of push through those major injuries and still compete. And that ultimately is what has kind of really led to this downfall and drop off over the past, 4, 5, 6 weeks, because I don't think Pavlovic has run out of ideas. I just think he's run out of resources to use in terms of formation and personnel. And I think from my point of view, I was really pleased with his personal positivity, his kind of seeming love to be here, and his kind of non-petulant reactions to situations. He'd always talk about the game. He's only recently talked about external factors and things behind the scenes in the club. And I think probably with the owners, as much as I like Bowen towards the end of the previous season, he was just so fed up with what he was working with. He kept saying, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I want to do, and fair play to him, he did it. But I think that negativity really sowed a lot of kind of discontent and a little bit of worry in Reading fans, but also the board themselves. And I think that's part of the reason why they made that change. I've no doubt that he was highly valued. But as you say, the length of time that it took to get Pavlovic in, which has been a good move, was really quite detrimental to, potentially the business we could have done with players on loan, contract situations and things like that. So we're in a situation now where I really do feel that we've got the right manager. I do strongly believe that. We just need a little bit more now in terms of quality and a little bit more kind of strength and depth and really, us saying, this is our starting 11. This is the best that we can possibly put out next season. This is kind of the best bench that we've got. And we've not really had that at times this season. And that really has been ultimately why we didn't make the playoffs when we all thought we would.
Yeah, well, let's go into that the drop off in just a moment. But Ollie, let's first recall that blistering start to the season. Obviously, the first 7 of 8 games in the Championship were victories. That was alongside a draw away in Middlesbrough as well. So nothing. I'm too devastating for the one game out of the 8 that we didn't win. And really, as Ben kind of alluded to, there is a sense of certain fans will box out that first 8 games and say, well, everything that happened after that was a disaster. But that's simply not true, because the first half of the season, Reading won 12, drew 4, lost 7, with a plus 6 goal difference. So that's a good first half of the season. It went all the way to the first 35 games of the season. Reading won 18, drew 6, lost 11. That's a playoff record. Reading are in the playoffs after the first 35 games. So they extended that form a long way. Obviously, they weren't going to keep winning at 7 out of 8. No one thought they would. But for you, Ollie, what did Reading do right over that period? Was it a case that we were ruthless? Was it the attack? Was it the defence? What for you were the key things that Reading did right in that first sort of 2/3 of the season?
I mean, the easy answer is to say that they got, pretty much everything right. I think you can take, these two things in isolation, that yes, the sort of drop off to, these sort of last 10, 11 games have been, unacceptable really, but that, take nothing away from that start, that those first 8 games, 22 points from a possible 24, no team in Championship history has got more points than that in the first 8 games. 6 clean sheets from 7, again, a Championship record, I think. They were just doing everything right. It was, the talk around them a lot was the XG, and whilst I don't want to push the discussion too far in that direction, it's on the same lines that we were pretty much scoring with most shots we had. Lucas Schell started the season like a house on fire. At the back, we were defensively organised. You know, Michael Morrison, Liam Moore coming into their own. Raphael started the season really well. You know, we saw Omar Richards had, you know, magically improved drastically over the summer. You know, always a fantastic attacking fullback, but we really saw sort of the defensive improvement from him. You know, Josh Laurent came in and formed a fantastic partnership with Andy Rinomoda straight away. Michael Olise really broke through. Obviously, last season, you know, we started to see him, you know, appear, you know, quite frequently, but really, you know, started now popping up with goals. You know, fantastic goal, I remember, against Barnsley, where the ball bounces to him on the edge of the box and he volleys it into the bottom corner. You know, getting assists as well. His delivery was great. And yeah, I think everything just sort of seemed to click, really. And, you know, we spoke about it at the time, but there didn't sort of really seem to be one key reason for that. You know, there's a reason for why we were doing so well, is that was because we were, you know, so tight defensively and fantastic going forward. But that almost sounds almost too simple. But I think in many ways that was just simply the case. I think Paunovic took things back to basics. You know, he had, you know, 2 weeks to work with his players before the start of the season. 1 week was him in quarantine. So he only had 1 week before the start of the season to start working with his players. And I imagine he just sort of just took them straight back to basics. And he also fostered this fantastic team spirit. You know, at the start of the season, we came accustomed to sort of these images of the squad huddling in the middle of the pitch. And, you know, it was spoken about a lot from, you know, all the players in interviews, really sort of how well Paunovic had done to foster that team spirit. And, you know, we will speak about it a lot. And I think for me, it's one of the main reasons why, you know, we struggled towards the end of the campaign, was because we had such a small squad, and Ben alluded to it earlier as well. You know, ultimately that's cost us, but I think at the start of the season, and, you know, I think throughout the whole season as well, that it was also a big plus for us, because it helped us, you know, form that unity, form that spirit. You know, we had a mass clear out last summer. You know, the squad was far too big last season. You had players sitting on the sidelines, you know, not involved, and that won't have been helpful for team morale. And the fact that, you know, everyone, you know, at the club was involved in match day squads at the start of the season, you know, you had this fantastic team spirit, and that can go an awful long way. So yeah, I think everything just sort of seemed to be going right for us. And, you know, it was a, you know, majestic start, and take nothing away from that, despite the way that the season's panned out.
Yeah, it feels to me like the defence and the attack overall, it was seldom a 10 out of 10 performance from one or the other, but you just consistently got 7 and 8s from it. And that just bubbled us along on a really nice level. We weren't world beating for those first 35 games that I pointed out, but it was enough to be in the playoffs. And one player in particular that had an absolutely awesome start to the season, Ben, let's forget his end for the moment, but Lucas Schau, 17 league goals up until February the 16th in 24 appearances. The attack mantra was to get the ball into Lucas Schau and then things will happen. And, you know, other players bounced off of that, and it really worked. And it was probably one of the best periods of form we've seen a striker have for Reading in the Championship in, you know, decades. And, you know, that was a joy to watch, and to see a player just capable of all aspects of the game, it felt. Seeing Lucas Schau for that first sort of two-thirds of the season, It totally, you could say it carried us, if you want to be uncharitable, but it almost defined us, I prefer to say, in terms of how Reading played and how difficult opposition's found dealing with us was.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most unexpected elements of this season, apart from, you know, the start and the overall performance in general, was Lucas Schau. And at Christmas time, you're thinking, well, he's going to hit 30 goals easy. You know, when he scored, we win games, and that's it. And the most refreshing thing about having Lucas Schau and the way that he was performing in the team was that A, he was staying fit, which we'd not seen before. And maybe other clubs had not seen that from him either, but also the fact that he was linking players into play and bringing the more attacking midfielders into play and giving them the ball back to be able to kind of stick it wide. So his link up play was phenomenal, and his confidence in front of goal was incredible as well. But you know, we need to look a little bit deeper than that in terms of have other players around him. So you look at Mate, he scored 12 goals, been out for majority of the season. You know, another good season from him, really. You know, Ollie talked about, you know, the defensive players, but that was outstanding. That was the one thing that needed to be sorted out from last year, and the fact that we just needed to stop conceding goals, and that's what happened in the first part of that season. But when you do that and you have someone as prolific and proficient up front as Lucas Chow, he's going to score goals and you're going to win games. And it's not a coincidence. You know, football's very, very simple. You win games, you get points, and that's that. But I think it's fair to say that his overall drop-off contributed to the whole teams and vice versa. I think there's a huge link there. I generally do feel that drop-off was obviously down to fatigue and the fact that he stopped scoring as well, in terms of some of the decisions that he made, and the penalty misses probably maybe affected him a little bit deeper than maybe we realised. But there was no other alternative at that point to bring other players into the fold and give him a break, and that's kind of what he desperately needed. And it goes back to that age old thing we talked about already about the squad depth and how desperately we needed some other options to be able to support him and the rest of the key players in our team. But, you know, hugely delighted with what Lucas Chow brought to the team. You know, he can be very proud of what he's done this season. And had he scored a few more goals towards the end of the year, then he may well have been in Player of the Year conversations even more than he was previously. So massively pleased that he's part of our club, and, you know, really, really great season for him. And I just hope, above all, that he can kind of build on that next season and keep going and pick up his early season form from this season into the early part of next season and beyond.
Yeah, if any player needs a break at the moment, it's certainly Lucas Chow. And that drop-off, 2 goals in 15 appearances post February the 16th. And actually, both of those goals came in games that we'd already won, basically. So he didn't actually win us a point after February the 16th, which I think is quite a stunning stat. Let's talk next about the kind of general... We'll do some bad points and then we'll finish recap on a good note. The niggling issues that kept on going through the season. You mentioned Lucas Chow's penalties, which he just missed too many of at key moments. Think of the Birmingham game, think of the Wickham game. I'm sure there's plenty more we can talk about. Belka Panovic's substitutions as well. He did have the opportunity to change games up in ways that he didn't take, even if the substitutes you think aren't, you know, completely up to standard. Players like Sonny Aluko, Sam Baldock, some of the young players did get left far too late, and he would bring on, I think it was in the Wickham game, he took off Michael Olise middle of the second half, which just didn't quite make sense in what we were trying to do. That's something that just kept bumbling along through the season. Injuries as well. Ollie was a big factor, we'll have to say, of Puskas being out a lot. We said Mate's out was out a lot. John Swift out for basically most of the season. And poor finishing at big moments, I think, particularly in the latter half of the season. We got ourselves into positions to take points from games or to do better than we were doing, and we just didn't hit the target. And I suppose those sort of things, ultimately, you know, they're kind of non-negotiables. You need all of those things to be going for you to be having a truly successful season.
Yeah, and, you know, it was those things that were going for us in those first 8 games. You know, everything that went right for us in that electric start, the you know, solid at the back, you know, scoring every chance we had. You know, it was almost a reverse of that. You know, particularly in these last 10 games, and it was certainly sort of less regularity in the second half of the season. I think the point on injuries is massive. I think for me, they're almost sort of 3 points. You know, sort of why I feel sort of Reading of you know, not made the playoffs this season. It stems from that small squad, but off that, you know, you look at the lack of recruitment in January, but also particularly the injuries. You know, we had a small squad anyway, but, you know, it was made an awful lot worse by the fact that, you know, several key players have missed, you know, fairly big portions of the season. You know, I've been putting together our end of season editorial this morning, just sort of been looking at you know, the figures for the number of games that players have missed. And, you know, John Swift has been unavailable for 32 out of 46 Championship games. And, you know, you only have to look at the impact that he made against Swansea with a fantastic ball for Yaku Mate. You know, how different could the season have been if he was fit? Andy Yeardom missed 23 games. Again, we sort of alternated at right back. Tom Holmes has filled in and done all right. Thomas Estevez, not too bad, but how well could we have done if we had a consistent right back down there? Yaku Mate's missed 21 games. Again, you know, we've seen the impact that he can have, the fact that he can score goals almost from nothing, really, and sort of score goals when other players aren't stepping up. And then that centre-back pairing, Liam Moore's missed 12 games and Michael Morrison's missed 11 games. And you have to say that, you know, perhaps if they had been around, then maybe we'd have got more points. You know, obviously, there's, you know, several games that I suppose stand out, and it's almost those games where teams are gonna sit in and sort of invite Reading's pressure on, and perhaps we've not dealt with that too much. You know, obviously the Wickham game stands out, where we lost to Adams Park, and you know, we lost to Birmingham twice. I think we've drawn a couple of games where we shouldn't have, where we could have got wins. We lost to Millwall. Drew with Forest, drew 0-0 with Preston, I remember, where Lucas Jean missed a penalty. And it was just these sorts of games, really, where, you know, that there was no sort of impetus or sort of energy from Reading. And it was these teams that were happy to sit back, and Reading couldn't break them down. And that's been a massive problem, I think, for us all of this season. So, yeah, look, there's a lot of factors, and it's disappointing considering the way the season started. You have to say, I think, you know, you can make the point all you want that it was a, you know, the season as a whole, finishing seventh and stuff like that is great progress, and it has been an overall positive season. But you have to say, considering the way we started it and the way that, you know, the second half of the season has panned out, and just the inconsistency, it is disappointing.
Yeah, well, it is the hope that kills you is the name of this podcast, and that very much is how I feel about this. Let's last kind of point on that collapse that we had then, Ben. What this idea of a turning point game was there one game which sent the team into a bit of a spiral? Having a look through the stats, we spoke about that Wickham defeat away from home. Again, Lucas Jouw penalty miss, 1-0 defeat. They had 10 men, but we went after that and won three games in a row. The Barnsley draw that we had, that huge playoff clash that we could have won and didn't, followed that up by beating Derby at home quite easily. There's actually a bit of a run where we drew away to Forest, a game that, you know, probably the better team, probably should have won, but drew. We then lost to Birmingham. I think we were really unlucky with that Birmingham game, because everyone else got a shot at Birmingham with Aitor Karanka in charge, and they were rubbish. Yes, they beat us early in the season, but we had the first game of Lee Bowyer. You know, it's a completely different ball game as soon as you play a team like that with a new manager. And he's a good manager as well, Lee Bowyer. And, you know, that loss did precede a poor run. One game actually that could, as you look at the stats, be interpreted as a turning point was the Brentford home defeat, which was not a bad performance at all. It was just one of those games that didn't fall for us. Now, the problem with it was a late defeat, and it really knackered us out. And we then had a succession of games and lost 3 out of 4 against pretty average teams. You mentioned, Ollie, that Millwall defeat. What else did we lose? Lost beat an awful Bristol City, but then we lost to Middlesbrough and then lost that Wickham game. And if you turn those into 4 points, then it's a completely different story for how the season turns out. So, Ben, do you think there was a turning point, or do you think it was just kind of a general steady decline as the season got towards its end?
I think you can pinpoint to really frustrating games and games that showed us that maybe we weren't as good as potentially either the players or the fans or both sets thought that we were. You know, the Wickham game being one. But to answer your question in full, I don't think there was any one game in particular that, you know, I thought, okay, well, this is it now. There've been instances in games. I think that Preston game was massive in terms of missing that penalty. And I'm not blaming Lucas Jouw for this, but, you know, in that game as a whole, we should have found a way to get through what they put up against us, and we didn't. And to my, you know, my opinion, I think that was the first game where we really had a slog. And Preston were very, very, you know, resolute in their defence, and we just couldn't break it down. And I think that was the first time that really I looked at him and thought, okay, maybe we're not as strong as maybe I think we are. I think Ollie made the 3 points about the drop off and you know the kind of decline at the end of the season. I would add to that we've got a lack of leaders in the team. And there's a naivety in the spine of the team, you know, players that we've relied on all season who just haven't had the experience up until now. I talk about Richards in there. I talk about Elise in there. And I think those two players have benefited most from playing, you know, almost every game and being involved in every single match they scored pretty much all season. The most frustrating thing about that is that they're two players that have really, I think, will really benefit from this whole season, but they're obviously two players that won't be with us next season. Richards definitely, at least 99.9% sure he won't be in a Reading shirt next year. So there's all these elements that combine to where we are now. And I think the key moments in those games, you know, we talked about the Preston game, obviously the Wigan game again, the Barnsley miss from Jow. You know, there's been other situations where we've not been able to grind results out, and really we should have done. I agree that the Brentford game was a real sucker punch. I felt really deflated after that. So there's not one game that I can pinpoint, but just a whole bunch of factors that really have contributed to us finishing outside the playoff zone. And you know, when you look at the table today, 7 points is quite a big gap, really. So yeah, it's been a sad end to what promised to be a very, very good season.
Well, let's talk about some positives in a second, but before that, I'm going to throw a bit of a stat attack at you and just give you a taste of how Reading fared statistically over the season. Reading had produced the most dribbles and were the most fouled team in the league in the Championship this season. They're also the most dispossessed. They had the eighth most shots, the fifth most shots on target, but the second lowest shots inside the six-yard box. So lots of shots, but barely any inside the six-yard box. They're also mid-table for shots in the penalty area. Now, to compare that to other teams, the teams who are top of the six-yard box shots, it's kind of, yeah, it's not really, it's a bit six, one half dozen in terms of whether they're any good or not. But the team's penalty area shots, that was Norwich and Watford. The best teams had shots inside the penalty area. Reading were mid-table for that as a stat. Individually, Lucas Yao finished as the fifth highest scorer. He also was the fifth most dispossessed player in the league and produced the 10th most poor touches, according to the stats. Michael Elise finished second for the most assists. None of those, statistically speaking, came through balls. Most of those came from crosses or set plays. He was also joint third for key passes. Ovie Ejaria produced the most successful dribbles in the league, and he was also the most dispossessed player as well. Defensively, Reading put in the third most tackles, conceded the second least fouls, and the sixth least amount of shots. So keeping the action on Raphael's goal to a minimum. And a final point, Omar Richards came out of the season with the most tackles in the league on a per game basis. So congratulations. So that's an Aaron Wan-Bissaka-esque performance. So certainly the Premier League tackle leader usually. Let's talk about some constant pluses then. Ollie, I'll throw some at you. You can throw in your own as well. The central midfield pairing of Andy Rinomoso and Josh Lauren was a huge plus all throughout the season. The rise of Tom McIntyre, Tom Holmes in the defence as well is something really hopefully we need to benefit from long term. Michael Elise's growth has been really good to watch this season. Tactically, actually, I think we've been pretty sound the entire season. We've rarely come out of a game and thought, God, we've been tactically outclassed. And actually, barring a couple of early 3-0 defeats early on in the season and probably a couple others like the Brentford game and Norwich game, we were always in games. This wasn't the Yap Stam style season where we go and get battered 7-1 or whatever every four or so games. We were in games most of the way through this season, and that always gave us a sniff. And I suppose that perhaps led to most of the frustration from us that we weren't able to turn that into a few more points.
Yeah, 100%, and I think that's been one of the, you know, obviously the way the season's ended has been disappointing. But you know, I suppose it is almost a pointless narrative. But I mean, the fact that we were 14th last season and that we have this season, you know, competed at the top end of the division with, you know, really teams who are better than us on paper, who, you know, three relegated teams that have come down in a period where it is almost, you know, easier than ever to go straight back up because of the pandemic, and sort of they've come down with massive quality in their squad. Brentford and Swansea beating the playoffs last season. So we've competed with some really, really good teams and held our own for a lot of it. Again, you know, with the caveat of the final 10, 11 games. But it's, you know, we've consistently been up there. And that's, you know, without sort of wanting to sound as if it's just sort of nice to be there, but it has been enjoyable in that fact. Just when you're rolling off those stats there, it sort of occurred to me, I don't think we've had a red card all season, which must be quite unusual, which I suppose shows good discipline. But yeah, I think for me, the rise of academy prospects has been fantastic. You know, the academy is always a massive sort of pride point for this football club, and you know, it's been more evident than ever this season. You know, Tom Holmes for me, the standout. You know, he was playing in the Belgian second tier last season, and he's gone on this season. You know, I'm sure he himself would admit he's played more than he probably expected to. But for me, he's looked really, really comfortable. Aside from a few sort of performances, you know, the one against Norwich last week was obviously one to forget. But in general, I think he's been brilliant. He's been comfortable. He's been asked to play at centre back, where obviously he's also been asked to fill in at right back and take him to that, you know, really, really well. So, you know, he's been great. Obviously, you know, Michael Olise speaks for himself, winning the EFL Young Player of the Year award, and you know, he for me is the most talented player to come out of the club's academy, bar probably Gylfi Sigurdsson. You know, genuinely, you know, watching him on the ball is an absolute delight, and I can't speak highly enough of his raw ability. You know, there's obviously areas of his game, you know, that I'm sure will improve as he matures. You know, his attitude at times, perhaps you can call into question, but his raw ability can hopefully take him an awfully long way, because he's a supremely talented player. Omar Richards, you know, really made that left back spot his own. I know he's not had much competition this season, but really coming to his own this season, and you know, gets a move to Bayern Munich, which is fantastic for the academy. You know, to have a player go on to play for, you know, one of the biggest clubs in the world. And, you know, Tom McIntyre's come on and sort of had his best season to date and established himself in the first team. You know, we've seen more debuts this season than any other, I think, apart from 2014 to 15, 11 debuts from the academy this season, which is fantastic. 40% of the players who made a championship appearance for Reading this season have come through the academy. Again, you know, fantastic stat. And, you know, it's, I think, whatever happens really sort of on the pitch, or, you know, where we finish in the table, the academy is always going to be a fantastic shining light for Reading. And it's been great to see that continue and sort of to see these players flourish this season, and to have that core of academy players in the first team is something that I think all fans of all clubs want to see. And we do it particularly well at Reading. So it's been great to have that this year.
It's a good point, actually. This has been a year, not necessarily where we've had loads of, you know, players floating around and coming on and making good cameos. We have had, you know, players on the bench and everything. But yeah, you're right. This has been a year where the academy players have been first team regulars and stars of that team as well. And I'm not sure I can think of a team that's had that since the likes of, you know, Jem Karachan and Alex Pearce and that sort of generation, which is, God, that's almost 10 years ago now. That's depressing. You're absolutely right on discipline. The only championship team in the championship not to have had a red card this season. Sheffield Wednesday have had 7 by way of comparison. No team has had fewer than the 48 yellow cards of Reading as well. Brentford on 50, the one just above us. So, it's been an interesting one, Ben, for the academy. I'd also say the thing is with Michael Olise as well is that it's been refreshing to see a player make that step up from being a kind of prospect that we all kind of rate to actually being a star of the team. We've had a lot of players come through in the last 5-6 years where we think they're the next big thing, and it's kind of fizzled. And whether, you know, if he does leave at the end of the season, I think it probably depends, as cynical as it is, I think for a lot of fans, it will depend financially as to whether that's a good thing or not. If Reading can make that, you know, make his success pay, then that's a good thing for the team. If he leaves under, you know, a small fee and everything like that, then it really will leave a sour taste in the mouth. But I think Reading fans almost settled for the fact that we're going to see him move on and go on to better things and wish him well in doing that. We just hope that the club can grow and invest as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things really for those academy players is, and I think they benefit from not having fans in the stadium, because they've spent most of their apprenticeship, if you like, in early years kind of playing in front of no fans. And so it's like for like, really. The opposition is obviously better. Games are slightly more intense, obviously. But the fact they've not had to cope with people getting on their backs, and particularly Lise, you know, he's done quite a few things that have been quite, you know, wayward passes and shots when he shouldn't have taken, free kicks, a massive area of improvement for him that's needed. But I think they've all benefited from not having fans in the stadium and being able to kind of express themselves, really. What I would add to that, of course, is that we've got players coming through now that we know we can probably rely on. You know, Tetek, obviously, the last couple of games has been very, very good, and it is a nice kind of option to that Reno pivot that we've got going. But the biggest positive for me is that we've got a manager who's done the absolute best that he can with what he's got. And I think football fans get ahead of themselves and they demand this and they want that and it should be this name or that name. But actually, for me, it's always been looking at the managers and saying, well, are they a good manager? And I base that on whether or not they've been able to utilise to the absolute fullest what they've got available, where other managers have kind of fallen down. You know, Paul Clement, Jose Gomez, as much as I liked him, didn't utilise and maximise what we had in the squad. And we've had years of effectively underachievement for the you know, supposed quality that we've had in the squad. And this year, I've not seen that. Yeah, obviously, we've talked to death about the drop-off and the decline in the performances over the last couple of weeks, but actually, the manager and the coaching team have done the absolute best they can with what has been given available to them. And we have to remember that he didn't put that team together, you know. So it's going to be interesting moving forward to see what he chooses to do with that. Whether or not we're able, in terms of financial point of view, to add to it, whether that be, you know, extensive new contracts or loanees or permanent signings or whatever. Obviously, you mentioned about Alise going and the money that we'd hope to get for that. Hopefully, some of that can be reinvested in the squad. You know, there's a whole host of reasons to be positive. And regardless of what people say, we've made progress. You know, physically and metaphorically, we've been able to prove to teams in this division that we can play football. The players, the core group of players that we will keep, know that they can compete at this level and do well. It's just that kind of game management and that kind of understanding of what needs to be done when it gets a little bit tougher for them. But, you know, all in all, I will personally look back on this season with very fond memories and look at it as a real positive season. And hope that, you know, the next time I see a team will be in the flesh and we'll be back at the Medeski Stadium in August.
Absolutely. And let's round off this recap then with some of those good memories. And we can each pick our favourite memory of the season then. There was the opening day surprise, that win over Derby. The early win over Watford, where I think everyone went into that thinking this is where the wheels come off. And we got a 1-0 win. Went and had an absolute romp at Blackburn, a nice 4-2 win there. Beat Nottingham Forest in front of the fans. Ben, you had a nice little appearance, a nice little cameo on Sky Sports for that. That was a really just a brilliant day. Tom McIntyre scoring his first goal against Luton for a nice little Giggsy sort of corner routine as well. Michael Alise getting a late winner against QPR. That Bournemouth game where 3-0 up at half time, brilliant performance that. And also added in the romp against Sheffield Wednesday, that probably the last time we put in a truly satisfying 90 minute performance as well. I'm torn between out of those two my two favourite moments, probably the Forest win in front of the fans, hearing that roar of URs as the players came out for the first time. Sadly, we thought, you know, it's going to be more fans for longer, but for the limited time we had fans in for the stadium then. And also that first half performance against Bournemouth, Ollie, was the best football we've played this season. Going 3-0 up, obviously held on for the 3-1 win. But we just went into a Friday night game knowing that we had to produce a performance and absolutely battered them for 45 minutes and then just cruised for the other 45. So what's your favourite moment of the season, Ollie?
Yeah, I was going to go that Bournemouth first half as well. You know, I think, as I said earlier, I don't think you can take away from those first eight games. You know, I think, you know, those first eight games was almost the most excited that I've been in a long time watching Reading, and it was great. But, you know, obviously it is early days at that point. But, you know, this Bournemouth game comes at the end of January, you know, where we've had our dip in form, where we had those four defeats in a row, sort of bumbled over Christmas and sort of, you know, gradually getting back on track. And, you know, then comes this Bournemouth game, as you say, on a Friday night. you know, almost, I suppose, sort of the first game where people started to say, you know, yeah, this is the biggest game of our season so far. You know, pretty much every game after that then becomes biggest game of the season. But it was the first sort of real game of the running, if you like, that, you know, we were like, if we win this, you know, we put ourselves in a really good position. And obviously we did just that. And yeah, that the first half was just sensational. And it was probably, you know, yes, after the first eight games, I thought, you know, we've got something pretty special here, and, you know, we've got a real chance of going up. As I say, then we dipped in form, but that win over Bournemouth was probably the first real time, the first sort of time I thought in my head, actually this team can do it. You know, we're playing a team who've come down from the Premier League, who've got sensational quality in their squad, to our playoff rivals, and we have battered them, we have dominated them, and we've been much the better team. And yeah, that day was fantastic. You know, Friday night under the lights on Sky, you know always a great occasion. But yeah, I suppose it was ill-fated optimism, as the whole season has been, really. But yeah, that game was probably the one time that I got really, really excited and really thought, yeah, we can do this.
Ben, what would you say for your favourite moment of the season?
Well, personally, the Forest game, because I was in demand for that game. Like, I was talking to everyone and anyone. So that for me was massive, absolutely massive. I think realistically, my absolute favourite moment probably would have been the Cardiff game, when the Cardiff away game, when Mate left both those players for dead with a nutmeg. And just, as I remember looking at that thing, oh my, like, this is going to be a great season. And I think because we'd not seen that kind of confidence and that flair and that kind of arrogance from our players, you know, Cardiff at that point were quite well, they were widely tipped to be challenging at the top end of the table. So that would definitely be. And the other thing is, well, I know we talked about the Bournemouth home game, but the Bournemouth away game, that first 45 minutes was just crazy. Like, you know, Sonny Aluko scored a goal from open play, and it was like, what's going on here? And obviously the second half was just an absolute collapse, and it was just a microcosm of being a Reading fan over, well, for all my 30 years or whatever I've been supporting for. But that first 45 minutes, Bournemouth away, we blew them away like we did at home. So there's a lot of moments, but I think if I had to pin one down, it would be the Cardiff away game, just because of the way we played, and just that kind of Mate. It was like a nutmeg, wasn't it, where he took two players out of the game. So yeah, definitely that, I think.
Yeah, there's plenty to pick from, which I think is the glory of it. So that's it. We'll go into the mailbag now and hear what you think as we go into the summer. We'll also hear from Veljko Paunović as he spoke after the Huddersfield game. Reading played 46 games this season, won 19, drew 13, lost 14, scored 62, conceded 54, and ended on 70 points, which I think is a points tally that pretty much no one predicted out of this club going into the season. So let's go on then into the mailbag after we've heard from Veljko Paunović.
To reflect, plenty of time to recover and re-energize ourselves and re-motivate, because, you know, we have everything to succeed here. We just have to align all the pieces. And I said, bring more pieces that are needed to be successful and sustain that success on a long term. I think that's the main thing we have to look at. And then go to the details, as you said, once you reflect, once you see what you need and what you should do better, and you know, start to work on that. It's very important. It's very important. The actions are very important.
For all the latest Reading news, analysis and opinion, visit the website at thetilehurstend.com.
Let's kick it off then with Dan, who has tweeted us in saying, well, it's the elephant in the room. How bad is the financial situation and how will it affect us? Ollie, you did a podcast with Keir Maguire, the Price of Football account, after the Reading FC finances were released a couple of weeks ago. That was for last season, aka 1920. Veljko Paunović had some really interesting quotes a couple of days ago where he said basically he wants the league, I think he was talking to the league, to give the club a chance. He says that this season has shown that we've got our finances back under a reasonable amount of order. We'll have to take his word on that. And that he thinks that the club should be allowed to invest in the squad in the summer and show that there is, you know, a competitive element of the club that can make money and actually not be a complete financial shambles. But, you know, Ollie, that is the kind of the reality for the last few seasons, that Reading have been a bit of a financial shambles. And as Dan says, how much do you think it will affect us?
Yeah, I mean, that play sounds as if Reading might be in a bit of trouble this summer with regards to the league. You know, there's no getting away from it that, you know, the financial situation at the club is precarious, is probably the best word for it. It's probably important to distinguish the fact that in terms of, you know, money that the money that Dae Young has is sufficient. He has an awful lot of money. He's probably one of, if not the richest owner in the Championship, and he is at the moment at least, and is still willing to pump that money in. It's just the fact that we have to comply with these FFP regulations, which, you know, we absolutely haven't over the last few years. You know, you're allowed to make £39 million loss, I think it is, over the course of 3 years. You know, when those accounts came out, I think it was a £40 million loss in 1920, which takes us up to £90 million loss, or around that figure, for the last 3 years, which is obviously way over the £39 million you're allowed to lose. So it is precarious, as I say. It's probably the best way to look at it. Cost cutting has taken place over the last year. You know, we mentioned last summer when not an awful lot of recruitment took place. In January, Reading were the only club in the Championship not to dip into the transfer market. You know, so they have kept costs down on that front. We obviously let go of a number of players last summer on high wages: Gareth McCleary, Chris Ganter, Manone, Mo Barrow, all players whose wages will still be included on his accounts. So letting all of those go last summer will be massive for the figures. This summer, you're looking at Shani Aluko and Sam Baldock going as well. You know, they won't show up until not next year, but the year after's accounts. You know, so Parrish is right that there are cost-cutting measures taking place, and hopefully that continues. You know, we've seen by, you know, the signing of Josh that you can pick up absolute gems on free transfers, and you would hope that those are the sort of signings that are made this summer as well. In terms of how it affects Reading, speaking to Kieran Maguire, he seemed, I don't want to say confident, but he seemed to think that a points deduction wasn't particularly likely for Reading, just based off the fact that an awful lot of clubs in the Championship have sort of exceeded the FFP rules. So, you know, from the league's point of view, particularly with the pandemic in mind, they might relax the rules a little bit, on the basis that, you know, you don't want to start next season with, say, 10 clubs on points deduction. Otherwise, it almost makes a mockery of the league, really. So Reading might be saved by the fact that most other clubs have also not acted particularly well financially. It's going to affect us for a number of years to come. I think that's the way it certainly seems. I think we're going to be paying for what Ron Gourlay did behind the scenes for a number of years. The signs of the last year have been positive with cost cutting. I just hope now that does continue, and that we don't, you know, see Dae Young get more and more desperate and just go, I'm just going to splash all this money, because we are heading in the right direction, but there's still an awful, awful long way to go.
Yeah, it's a good summary. I do think that you're right. If there's 10 clubs starting next season on minus 6 points, there's almost no point in doing that. The likelihood of a transfer embargo, I think, is much, much higher in practical terms. And basically, that'll mean, I think, that in reality, the club will have to sell players before they can bring anyone in. And that's how it's been at loads of clubs for years and years and years. So that's not a too bad a scenario to be in. And Reading have players that they can sell. We'll probably get onto that in a little bit. And Sam asking, if the club was to receive a £5 million bid in the summer for Lucas Shaw, would you sell him? Fun fact, we owe Sheffield Wednesday £1 million for Lucas Shaw this summer. We also owe Inter Milan about £1 million and a bit quid for George Puskas, because we very intelligently decided to make those deals spread out over a few years that haven't run out yet. So that's £2 million down the sink as it is. And I suppose, Ben, when it comes to Lucas Shaw individually as a sellable prospect, it's difficult because he's in his prime. He's not an old player, but we've seen the good and the bad of him this year. And that means that he's not a £20 million player who scored 30 goals this year. He's not an Ivan Toney who's got, you know, guaranteed goals in him. He just kind of hovers in the middle in terms of evaluation, and therefore it almost makes him less point selling him, because Reading can just hope that they get the good and don't get the bad.
I think that would depend on the other business that they do. I think, you know, when we spoke last time, there's so many other players that you probably look to put on the table to sell, or at least entertain bids for, before you got to Lucas Shaw. well. I suppose it depends how desperate you know the club got. My concern would be that the, you know, if there was another player that's had a season like Joao has, and we could afford him, would he come to us? Probably not as a replacement. So, you know, it's all well and good clearing these players out and selling them. You've got to replace them with something. My other concern about recruitment is that obviously with Bowen and his team, they did an awful lot of groundwork on Loren. I would imagine that there was some groundwork put on him before he joined as well, even before Bowen was talking about him publicly, really. My concern is that with Paunovic and his lack of kind of knowledge and understanding of the leagues in this country, is there going to be suitable recruitment, and who's actually driving that? You know, there's no director of football, which we've talked about before, but who's actually overseeing the transfers and who's bringing them in, and what wages are we paying them? So I think from from Jao's point of view, if we hadn't shifted anyone and it got to late summer and someone went, here's 6 million, we probably would take that. I don't see him being urgently out of the door for that money. And when you put it like that, and we owe other clubs sort of 2 million or whatever, it kind of defeats the objective of selling him, because we then have, you know, less than 3 million to play around with a potential replacement, and that's just not going to happen. So I think to answer the question, it's a great question. It would depend on what the business has gone prior to that, and at what period of the summer that potential bid arises.
Yeah, definitely. It's just such a tough one, and it depends who's making these decisions as well, because I think usually it's been Dai Yong last few years, and the CEO, Deang Pang, is very much a Dai Yong man, so probably will be the man at the top who's making these decisions, and he's not like selling his players in the last few years. And I think it's quite clear that Reading probably need to start being good at selling players to have a successful summer, or to the very least, you know, we talk about point deduction and transfer embargoes to avoid that. Nick Holton saying, concerns, do we have any concerns about the number of players out of contract in 2022? Now this summer, Omar Richards is out, as we believe, going on a free to Bayern Munich. Tom McIntyre and Michael Morrison need to be sorted out. We've sorted out Luke Southwood. He's added another 2 years to his contract. But 2022, we've got Elise, Swift, Rinomota, Mate, Yeardom, Laurent, Raphael, Holmes and Araruna out of contract. That's according to Transfer Market. So that might not be 100% up to date. But Ollie, that's a pretty significant list of players who it's difficult in two senses. One, because you want to sign those players up to new deals. And two, because if we get a bid for them and, you know, you're Yeardom, you're Mate, you've been here for a few years, you want to move on with your career, you want to get to maybe it's the French top flight for Mate or Premier League or whatever, you're probably going to want to be moving, aren't you?
Yeah, I'd imagine so. I mean to answer that question, you know, very simply is yes, there are huge concerns about players contracts expiring. You know, the fact we've probably only got it's probably only about four, five, six players contracted beyond the end of next season, which is, you know, very worrying indeed for sort of long term planning of the football club. You know, we've seen this season, you know, Omar Richards is a prime example of Reading letting a player's contract run down. You know, why on earth they didn't offer him a contract, you know, last summer. You know, I know he hadn't been particularly impressive or consistent or whatever going into last summer, but he's a young player with 1 year left on his contract. You know, at the very least, offer him one more year. And you know, we've always been burnt by that this year, and the fact that he's now going to go to Bayern Munich on a free transfer. And look, even if we'd sold Richards this summer, you know, we could have got, you know, say 7 or 8 million for him. The fact is that it's not necessarily Reading, you know, keeping these players around for use in the team. It's the fact that we can, you know, make good value on these players. You know, we've spoken an awful lot about how Reading just simply cannot seem to sell players particularly well, in the fact that they either let their contracts run down or they hand them massive contracts to end up costing us more. So, you know, we need to get players tied down. You know, this summer still, you know, as you mentioned, Michael Morrison and Tom McIntyre. For me, I would offer contracts to both. I think both can play really important roles next season. But yeah, then we have to start looking at the players next summer, because otherwise we're going to come to a situation where, you know, either similar to Richards this season, where you get players next January who will be available on Bosman transfers and they'll be able to go free to other clubs when we could have made decent money out of them, you know, or we'll get to next summer and we have to sort of almost build you know, build from the ground up again, which, you know, look, we know there are solid foundations in the squad. We know there are good players who, you know, can perform on their day. You know, it's not as if we need a whole sort of squad revamp like we've said in the past. You know, there are good players at this club, but we need to get them tied down on contracts for ease of resale value or for use on our own team.
Yeah, 100%. Elgin Jericho saying, what is the likelihood that Paunovic doesn't start the next season as a manager? His recent post-match interviews haven't been too positive. Brackets, I'm hoping he's given a chance. Also, if he were to go, who'd you replace him with? It's going to be a long post-season, methinks. Well, I think, speculating over who might replace him is probably not too much worth our time. But for the chances of him going, he has been saying that, you know, it's kind of been casting a little bit of doubt. I'm not too desperate to read too much into that, Ben, but, you know, we can't rule out the prospect of the club deciding to change things because of the collapse. That's what they did with Mark Bowen when we didn't really see that coming. But I just don't think that it certainly wouldn't be a good thing because, you know, as El Ginge points out, it's not immediately obvious who you would replace him with.
Well, no, the issue with that is obviously, you know, for the record, I think he should stay. I think we're all agreement on this pod that he should stay and should be given a chance. But, if they were to sack him, they've got to pay him compensation and they've got to get into negotiation with potentially a much more expensive manager. You know, there are a number of managers that could do the job. But, you know, you, as I said earlier, you have to look at it and say, has he done the best that he's been given? Yes, he has. Has he done better than what was expected? 100%, of course he has. I've kind of got over the fact that you know, Bowen left and kind of rationale by the fact they wanted to move in a different direction from a stylistic point of view. That's fine. But this time, I don't really know what excuse or what reason they would have to kind of get rid of him, really. So I would be very hopeful that he would stay. The fact that he's got a longer pre-season or post-season, whatever you want to call it, you know, plus the Euros is probably quite a good thing because he's now got time to really take some stock, think about, you know, play over the decisions that he's made and the management team has made, think about the players that he wants to bring in, think about the players that he wants the table to sell potentially, and then go from there. My biggest concern is that clubs don't do their business early. Because of the Euros, because they'll be hanging out for a potential bargain from the teams that are on show in that tournament. So I much rather clubs getting their business done early, getting the release list out, thinking about, you know, tabling those players for bids and whatnot, and going from there, because then you're able to start forming the nucleus of hopefully what is going to be a positive squad and a positive season into 21-22. So I think he will be there, but I sadly won't be surprised if he's not come the start of the season in August.
Well, he has been kind of suggesting that he is at the forefront of building a squad for next season. So we have to take him at his word for that. And hopefully, you know, can draw a line under this as an argument. But if we have to do an emergency podcast in the summer, then, you know, we'll drag ourselves out to do it, I guess. Final question then for the mailbag. And thanks for the entire season for those of you who have tweeted us, emailed us, sending questions on Facebook and everything. It is a real pleasure to have people, you know, drive the conversation and drive the debate around the club. We are a podcast by fans for fans at the end of the day. So to all those who have sent a question in, big thank you for that. And Noonan sends in the final question of the season saying, in 20 years time, which players will we still be talking about from this season? Quick answers then, guys, as we're getting off time. I think Michael Olise is probably the most likely one. Ollie, Andy Benamotta, there's a chance, and Josh Lauren, we could say this is the first year of a decade-long partnership of those guys in centre midfield. That'd be nice to be talking about. Maybe Lucas Schau as well for his season. But I think Michael Olise is, you know, the year, it's kind of the Gylfie Sigurdsson-esque year that we got to enjoy him before he went on to big things, is probably the most likely one, isn't he?
Yeah, I was about to compare him to Sigurdsson. I mean, I already have compared him to Sigurdsson on this podcast, but yeah, you know, we still speak about Gylfie now and are immensely proud of what he's gone on to achieve in his career. But yeah, you know, certainly Olise and Richards too. You know, who knows whether he'll be a success at Bayern, but certainly those two, and, you know, the other academy boys as well. You know, but certainly Olise and Richards are the two that I would say are going to go on and have very long and very, very successful careers because they're both immensely talented. So, yeah, I think it's going to have to be Olise or Richards.
Ben, who would you say?
Yeah, I'd go Richards. I think the fact that Bayern Munich, you know, such a good club, well run on and off the field, the fact that they've shown faith in him and given him a contract and, you know, sort of chucked him into their squad, I think he'll catch a break there and I think he'll go on to be absolutely fantastic if he can sort out sort of, you know, a bit more of his attacking play. But yeah, for me, it's Richards 100%.
Cool. Well, yeah, as you may be aware, this is the last podcast of the season, but do send in those questions if you have any thoughts over the summer and everything. We'll hopefully be dropping back in if there is, you know, even the slightest bit of news, you might be dropping back in. So do keep sending in those questions and any general thoughts and feedback and opinion on the show. We're always willing to field it and to have, as I say, you drive the debate. So let's move on now into news bites and round off what's been going on around the club in the last week.
You're listening to the Tilehurst End Podcast by Reading fans for Reading fans.
Let's tick off the other teams of Reading FC before we talk about the player of the season. The women's team, they're their final game of the season today. They were unfortunately playing Chelsea, who needed to win the league. Chelsea did that. They beat them 5-0. So Reading finished 7th in the WSL in the end. That's 24 points in 22 games. So not a huge return, but you know, it's a hugely contrasting league from the top teams to the bottom. So to be in the middle of that is probably just about right for Reading. Sadly, the last games for Farah Williams and Ang Howard James in that game as well. So huge congratulations to them on their Reading career, in particular Farah Williams, who the Tilehurst End sponsored this season, and who, you know, as a footballer, to put together her type of career and all the England caps and what she's done at Reading and all the rest of it, absolutely huge congratulations to her on her fantastic career. Looking towards the next generation, the under-23s finished their season against Wolves on May the 10th, so hopefully the Club Academy Twitter account will be following that so we can keep an eye on what's going on there. The under-18s finished their season this week with a 6-1 defeat to Arsenal and a 6-4 defeat to Southampton, so they were 11th in the 13-team Premier League South, ahead of Southampton and Leicester, so not, you know, not a disaster, but 11th they finished this season, so the under-18s finishing with a bit of a whimper, sadly. One man who did not finish with a whimper at all, Josh Laurent, the official club player of the season. The Tilehurst End player of the season vote will be opening shortly. We're just ticking off the player of the month at the moment. That vote's just open today. So Josh Laurent, the club player of the season. Ollie, who did you vote for?
I voted for Michael Morrison, but I've got no real complaints with Josh Laurent. Look, I think it's great we've had so many candidates this year. You know, we've had years gone by where you've almost struggled to pick one player who you think deserves it, but you know, you could have picked from from sort of four or five, really, I suppose, which I know we're going to do on the Tilehurst End. I voted for Michael Morrison just because I think, you know, you've seen in his absence what Reading missed from him. I think he's been absolutely colossal at the back this season, chipped in with a few goals. You know, that goal at Bristol City will not be forgotten in a long, long time.
That is the definition of chipping in, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, obviously, you know, a defender by trade, and you know, does everything you want from a centre half. You know, he's brave in the area, wins countless aerial balls. You know, puts his body on the line. You know, several blocks, clearances, tackles. You know, he's done it all, really, and been fantastic. But you know, no complaints about Josh Laurent. You know, come in on a free transfer and, you know, instantly become a mainstay of the side, and then miss one game all season. And really sort of that box-to-box player that we've missed the last couple of years. And yeah, he's formed a great partnership with Renamotta, and he seems to be a great sort of character around the place as well. You know, always smiling, always laughing. You know, clearly a very popular member of the squad. So yeah, no complaints.
You know, I think you've nailed it there. It's that likability, isn't it? He's got the social media is always really fresh with him and everything like that. I'm not saying that Michael Morrison and et al. Don't have that, but he does seem to have the X factor, the extra 5% that fans really click with, and he totally deserves it. I completely echo your sentiments as well on Morrison. He got my vote, but yeah, no complaints for Josh Laurent. Ben, who did you vote for?
I mean, exactly the same as you two. I went Morrison just because of his consistency and the fact that I just felt he improved on last year. He's a natural leader. I think, you know, I think Moore will leave this summer, and I think Morrison will be club captain. I think he'll sign a new contract. I don't think he'll leave. So yeah, I went Morrison, but within that shout, you got to look at Richards as well because of the step up that he's made and the consistency and the level that he's been able to reach. You know, it's the same with Lorraine as well in terms of his kind of step up to from Shrewsbury to where we are now. So yeah, can't complain with Lorraine really at all. But yeah, my personal vote was Morrison.
Yeah, and I think you can make a case for Omar Richards, you can make a case for Michael Olise, Lucas Zhao, you could also make a very convincing case for, probably if you swap the season around, usually helps if you have a good end to the season for these sort of votes. But yeah, there's, as you say, Ollie, lots of candidates. And yeah, massive congratulations to Josh Laurent for winning the club player of the season. Let's see if he can do the double with the Tarlas then player of the season as well. I'm also very aware that the three of us voted for the player that didn't win the fan vote. And yet we call ourselves the podcast by fans for fans. Perhaps we are not as in tune with everyone as we like to think we are, but let's move on then and round off the season with a look ahead to the next time round.
Be loud and be proud and back the boys and make some noise. Come on, you Oz!
Shout out to this week's podcast sponsor, ZCZ Films, showing that age is no barrier to being a hooly hoop.
Let's tie up the prediction league before we preview 2021-2022. And it was a thrilling end. Westy had a bit of a lead going into the last couple of games. He had 2-1 versus Huddersfield and 3-1 versus Norwich as his predictions. Games that had those scorelines until basically the last kick. So as it is, those two goals deprived him of 5 points. Handbags, meanwhile, picked up 5 points in the last three games. He had 4-1 for Norwich and a draw for Huddersfield. So he crept in to take the title. Handbags finishing on 30 points. Westy on 28, myself 27, Ollie, you had 26, and Sim on 21. So massive congratulations to Dave Handbags Harris for his triumphant sealing of the Prediction League. We'll be back next year. And again, that will hopefully be a nice little addition to the podcast that people aren't too fed up of hearing about at the end of the show. Right, let's have a couple of quick questions then for next season. And really, I think it's difficult for as we sit here and talk about what we're expecting. There's the danger that with the finances and everything that we'll be stuck with the same problem. Again, we've talked about the small squad this year. There's no reason to believe that'll be fixed, in my opinion, for next year. Unless we can bring the kids through. We've had a lot of kids on the squad this year that we haven't actually really used. And I also kind of want to worry that I do have is that if we do start well, we'll be sat here in February of next year. Let's say we're fourth. We'll just be worried that we're going to have another drop off. I think that fear is going to be really hard to get out of us for next year. But there's plenty to be positive about as well. One reason to worry then, I've kind of just given mine then, and then one reason to be hopeful as well. Ollie, what's your two for these particular areas?
I think first things first is that it's not unusual to go into the summer feeling a sense of uncertainty. I think we've pretty much felt that most summers for the last sort of 3 or 4 years. Really, you know, there's a lot up in the air. As you say, you know, sort of the size of the squad and certainly players going out, and that would probably be my main worry, is sort of replacing players that we sell, because I think the club have a need to sell players or something, bit because of the finances. You know, we know Richards is going, at least they're almost certain to follow him out of the door. As we've mentioned, you know, Morrison and McIntyre still not tied up and with contracts, and I'm sure there'll be a couple of others that will depart as well because of the need to get funds in. So yeah, my main worry then will be getting players in to replace them, because, you know, all of those players we've talked about have been key players for Reading this season, and you know, it's a lot easier said than done to replace them. And with Reading's, you know, recent record of recruitment, I don't particularly trust, you know, we don't really know who's in charge of recruitment. So that would be my main worry, is that we're not able to sort of replace players. And, you know, that's bitten us before, in the fact that when we lost the playoff final, you know, one of the main reasons why we, you know, sort of bombed the next season was because we couldn't replace Ali Al-Habsi and Danny Williams. So, yeah, that would be my main concern for next season. Reason to be hopeful, you know, probably the fact that we sort of said the same last summer and it's worked out not too bad. You know, I think we've come to learn with Reading Football Club is that, you know, anything probably, you know, might and probably will happen, and almost you've just got to let it play out. I think we're in a good place with the manager. I think he knows what he's doing. He's had a great first season in English football. You know, it's the first time since 16-17 that we've kept the same manager from game one to game 46. So, you know, that's got to sort of form some sort of basis of optimism, I suppose, for the new campaign, is that we are hopefully sort of trying to build a long-term plan going forward. And also just the fact that there's going to be fans back. You know, it's been a weird old season, and it's been tough sort of following it from afar. You know, with the perils and the uncertainty of iFollow. You know, just a step. You know, I was you know, not lucky enough to be able to get back into the Mad Stad in December. So to finally be able to get back in August and to have a full season, you know, with fans back in stadiums, it's just going to be immense. And I think, you know, whatever happens sort of on the pitch, I think this season has sort of taught us that, you know, nothing can quite beat being in stadiums. So it's going to be fantastic to be back there, and that's probably the one thing that I'm looking forward to more than anything else.
Yeah, I noticed earlier actually, Oxford got into the League One playoffs, so hopefully there's an outside shot of a bit of a derby next year. That'd be a nice one to have the fans in for, perhaps early on in the season, if we can get them down the Mad Stad, and a bit of a, you know, near enough full house for that one. I think in terms of reasons to be hopeful, it is difficult, because the reasons that I would say to be hopeful are that the manager and the spine of the squad will be a year older, a year wiser, and hopefully all intact. You know, if we have that Rinnemott alarm base, if we can make sure that we have McIntyre, Holmes and Morrison as the three sort of centre-backs we're kind of picking from, if it's Southwood or Raphael with Yeardom, a new left-back, if you've got Mate, Ijaria and maybe a new centre-attacking mid, or obviously Swift, if he's still around, and Lucas Schau, that's a good first 11, and it's something to build off. And if you have all those things, I see no reason why, with some good kids and some good signings to bulk out that squad and to offer alternatives, you've got a pretty decent squad there, or certainly absolutely no reason to think it's any worse than Nottingham Forest or Blackburn or QPR or Cardiff, or the sort of teams that think they're going to be in the playoff hunt next year. So absolutely no reason why that team can't compete, if that team is the team that we have, obviously. Ben, what would you say for your one sort of reason to worry and one reason to be hopeful for next season?
Well, the thing I'm most worried about is that any money that we get through the door for players is not reinvested in the squad. That's my main concern. I think there'd be a temptation to chuck all the money back at the creditors or the, you know, the debts that we've got. Whereas, you know, it's going to be very difficult to replace the players that we know that will more than likely leave and are leaving in Rich's case. But the other thing that I'm massively concerned about is the possibility that John Swift leaves. I'm very concerned by that. I am a Swift super fan. I've made no qualms about that. I'm not embarrassed by that at all. But he leaves, and the whole thing, you know, certainly the attacking midfield collapses. Really, he is the one player that I would desperately wanna keep at the club. So I'm really, really concerned that we might get an offer for him, and the club might go, yeah, off you go. In terms of hopeful, like you, Mark, you know, the spine of the team, I think will be there next year. I think the one thing that I've really wanted to see this year is Mate playing up front. And we saw that yesterday, and he was excellent, really, to be honest, for the last game of the season. And I'm kind of hopeful that he will be given a more elevated role. But I think, you know, as Ollie sort of said as well, we've got a manager who knows what he wants to do. I don't think that the board will make a change with him. So, you know, there's lots of positives there. And the other thing as well, the final thing, I'm really buzzing for the new kit, because I'm just desperately hoping there's no sponsor on it. In 150 years of the club, please don't put a sponsor on it. I know we're desperate for the money, but just for 1 year, give us a shirt that, you know, hasn't got a sponsor on it. That's what I'm really hopeful for.
Yeah, it's going to be our 150th anniversary year next year, which it should build out some sort of hype around, you know, the kit. It should be interesting to see what they do with that. Kasumo's sponsorship is up at the end of the year. So, yeah, I suppose it's just one of the fun things that we get to wait for over the summer. There's obviously going to be a lot of time waiting and everything like that. And Paunovic already said that we're waiting for other teams to finish their season before we can really get stuck into the transfers and everything like that. So it's going to be a slow burner, but, you know, things like the new kits, the friendlies being announced. I think they're going up to Scotland for a training camp. All these sort of things are the fun things that we get to look forward to over the summer with no football, and obviously the Euros as well, which should be, plenty of football to watch for us to go on for. And final question then, where do you think we'll finish next season? This takes into account what you think will happen, not what you want to happen, what you think will happen with the transfers, with the squad, with the manager, with the finances. Where do you think we'll end up? And I'll start us off by saying I think we'll finish about eighth next season. And the reason I think we'll have what will probably roughly be the same sort of season as this year is I think we'll probably start a bit slower, but hopefully there is just going to be a bit more of a consistent momentum to be built up over the season, especially if that involves us playing more of the kids, such as, you know, if Southwood, if Tetek, players like Melvin Lambert, Thierry Nevers, if they're going to be much more involved next season, you can expect it to be a bit of a more of a build-up. But I do genuinely think that this team, with some money being put into it, with some reinvestment, will be good. There is that quite large doubt in my head that Reading won't know how to sell players, that we will be belligerent. If we do end up having Michael Olise handing in transfer requests, it would not be a shock. But I do think that Reading have it in them, under Veljko Paunovic, with this spine of the team, to formulate a good season. I really don't think we'll be in the playoffs, but you know, that's just about where we can end up around in the championship otherwise. Ollie, what would you say for where you think we'll be sat here now?
Yeah, I'm of a fairly similar mindset. As I said, there's a lot of uncertainty going into the summer, but there is a strong spine of the squad, and there are a lot of good players in the squad. So, you know, but I certainly don't think we're going to fall drastically down the table. I think we probably will be top half again. You know, whether we challenge the top six, you know, I think we might give it a go, but, you know, certainly probably we're not quite sort of the surprise we are this season. You know, with players leaving as well, as I said, I'm not too confident we'll replace them that well. But yeah, there are good players in the squad. I think, you know, also what makes me think we probably finish a bit lower than we did this season is that you look at some of the other teams in the championship who are shaping up to have pretty good campaigns next season. Nottingham Forest under Chris Hughton, for one. You know, yes, they've tailed off the last couple of weeks, but you know, I'd massively rate Hughton as a manager, and I think he's turned their fortunes around. So I think they'll have a good year next year. QPR finishing immensely strongly under Mark Warburton, and I think they'll do pretty well as well. So I think I think we will finish lower probably than this season, but not massively lower. So I'll go 10th for next season.
Ben, what do you think?
So what's really frustrating is that you've asked Ollie first all three of his podcasts, and he's taken almost all my ideas. So when I literally, when you said that, when you started the question, I wrote down 10th, and he's literally just said 10th as well. So I'm going to change my answer and just go top half. Top half is fine for me. It's very difficult. I can't add anything else to what you chaps have said, really. I think the key for me is what other clubs choose to do with their recruitment and their managers. And I know that's a bit of a cop-out, but, like, you know, I read about QPR, you know, Warburton essentially going to the FA. If he goes to the FA in the role that he's being touted for, they're going to have to get someone else in. I think they're going to struggle. It's the same with Forest. Forest, very trigger-happy. They might choose to get rid of Hughton, which would be a stupid decision, but it might aid us. So it's going to be an interesting league next year with fans back as well. You know, obviously got West Brom coming down, who will be sort of favourites to be there or thereabouts next year. It looks like Fulham might be down as well, and again, reasonably good bets to go back up. You got clubs coming up from League One that potentially could do well as well. So there's a lot of sleeping giants in this league now. And I really think it's going to be a very, very interesting postseason with those clubs. But, you know, from my point of view and from our club's point of view, I would just love us to finish top half again. We need a few years off from a relegation battle. And I think that we are way better than the last few years have shown, you know, what we've done in terms of league finishes. So I did say 10th, but Ollie's nicked that, so I'll just say top half generically.
Mate, you try and host a podcast by going A, B, 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 A. It's so much easier to go A, B, A, B, A, B. And
no, definitely, I get that. It's just funny though. It's just like, I just feel like I'm agreeing with Ollie all the time, but it's like minds, isn't it? Which is good. So yeah, just made me laugh when Ollie said 10th and I'd written it down before.
switch to ninth if you want me to. Sure I can go ninth or 11th.
Can we do like 9.5? Is that a league position? Do that. 10 3/4, something like that.
Ollie just, you know, he's just been here longer. That's why he gets the
best. I know, and he did it so well, and you did it so well, and you managed this really, really well and keeps on task. But it's just really funny when he said 10th, and I was like, I've just written that down. But yeah, well, I think Ollie settled for 9.5, and I'll go 10.5, and then we're good.
That sounds fair.
That sounds fair, absolutely. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have this. We've actually just had like the classic last minute technical glitch just as we were finishing off the podcast. So we almost made it, very much like Reading. We fell at the last hurdle. But Ben, it has been a pleasure having you on the podcast this week.
Well, thank you, sir. Thanks for picking me first. It's been great. You know, it's been a fantastic season and being involved in the pod and doing the column as well. So thanks to everyone for reading and listening. And it's just been really enjoyable and hopefully it's been sort of semi-enjoyable. Listening to me ramble on about whatever I've been asked by Mark, either first or second. So thanks very much, everyone.
Occasionally third as well, if it's a big one. And Ollie as well. Thanks as well for coming on.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I can't believe Ben's nicked my answer for that one. it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. Yeah, no, it's always great to come on. And, you know, obviously the season's not panned out as we hoped it would after sort of 7 or 8 games. But, you know, it's been great to pop on whenever and discuss it. And hopefully another relatively strong season next season.
Absolutely. And as always, it is by far the most important thanks I can give is the people who listen to the podcast, follow us on social media and read the website. It is why we do it. We like to think we have some sort of vague semblance of an idea of what Reading fans think, and we put it out there. And luckily, a few of you listen to it, and we wouldn't do it without that. And it's massively, massively something that we appreciate and that we hope that we can continue to do next season with all of your support. It's been, well, I think we've done a pretty good job of summing up this season in the last hour and a half or so. But I think just to look ahead to next season, we just hope to be with you again, be it by the podcast or the website and everything. And thanks for joining us next season as we go into it. And we hope to see you online and maybe in person next season. Come on, you ass. It's right.